Okay, thank you very much, and good morning, everyone. And first, this is the Finance and Administrative Committee, and I'd like to first move the approval of the agenda. Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, the ayes have it. I'd like to move approval of the minutes. Is there a second?
Second.
Moved and seconded. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the ayes have it. I'd like to begin with a brief overview of the agenda. First, our CFO, Dennis, will ask for the committee's approval to delegate the authority to negotiate and execute all line of credit renewals or new lines of credit agreements. This authority would be granted to the general manager, the CFO, or the treasurer, which would allow management to more quickly and efficiently manage our cash flow needs. Next, the committee will be asked to approve changes to Metro's drug and alcohol policy and testing program. Adoption of these documents will satisfy the FY 2016 Federal Transit Administration's drug and alcohol policy audit findings. Staff will also review the updated drug and alcohol procedures manual. Following these two actions, there will be several information items. Elizabeth Sullivan, the Director of Internal Compliance, will provide the committee with a quarterly update on Metro's progress in addressing the FTA's financial management oversight report. Mr. Ansicki and Assistant General Manager for Transit Infrastructure, Andy Off, will walk through the FY 2016 second quarter financial update. And lastly, we'll continue discussions on Metro's proposed FY 2017 operating and capital budgets. The CFO will address questions previously raised by members, including updated revenue forecasts, long-term trend lines, and the status of the renewal of the capital funding agreement. So with that, I'll turn the floor over to our CFO to begin discussions today. Dennis?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This agenda item seeks board authorization to reduce Metro's line of credit and to delegate to the general manager and his team the authority to negotiate and execute Metro's line of credit program. As the committee is aware, Metro uses its lines of credit to meet liquidity requirements that support Metro's normal operations. Historically, staff sought board authorization annually to amend or extend existing lines of credit, which typically last 364 days. Today, Metro has four lines of credit with three financial institutions totaling $302.5 million. And these lines of credit, as you'll see on the screen, will expire between March and June of this year. Metro's line of credit, as you'll recall, was increased from $150 million to $302.5 million in 2015 to address increased liquidity needs. As capital expenses and the reimbursements therefrom from FTA has increased, Metro has stabilized its cash flows and reduced outstanding short-term debt by over $300 million since 2015. So the proposed LOC capacity reduction will enable Metro to further reduce unnecessary financing costs. Should the board approve this request, staff expects to reduce Metro's line of credit capacity from $302 million to $250 million, with the outstanding line of credit balances trending down below $50 million by June of this year. So, with respect to the framework, other than reducing the line of credit and delegating to the general manager the authority to execute the LOCs, the fees, the duration, and the terms of the current lines of credit remain the same. Furthermore, any changes to indemnification that will be required going forward will still require board approval. A key benefit of this delegation is the flexibility that it provides Metro to better align our cash flows with the lines. And we estimate that that flexibility will save Metro substantially with respect to cost going forward. With that, staff urges committee approval of the resolution, and I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to open the floor for any discussion. Mort?
Question on the chart that shows a drop to 50 million. Is that a function of improved processing on our part, or is that assuming a long-term debt issue has been done by that time?
It assumes a couple of things. One, obviously, is the more fundamental reimbursements from FTA. As we have reported to the board, we've recovered over $500 million over the last few months. Secondly, the board, as you recall, authorized the execution of an intermediate line, debt issuance to actually pay off some of the lines of credit, given the better rates that will be associated with those. And going forward, we expect that transaction to take place between now and May, which adds to the, or contributes to the reduction in the outstanding lines.
Further?
Thank you.
Michael?
Dennis, the resolution language talks about the aggregate amount of WMATA's open LOCs shall not exceed $302.5 million from the effective date through July 1, 2016, and the aggregate amount of open LOCs shall not exceed $250 million after July 1. Are you asking for a one-time delegation to cover the period from now through the end of FY17, the period July 1, 2016 through June 30th, 2017? Or are you asking for an indefinite authority to negotiate extensions of lines of credit for years, fiscal years after that, after July 1, 2017?
It is an indefinite authority at the lower cap. If you recall, the current line is 302. We're asking to go down to 250. And historically, we've come down to you yearly, and the board has approved that since we need this for operations. What we are asking is to simplify the process, to provide the flexibility to align, given based on where markets are. We can have the ability to do interim negotiations with institutions to further save Metro money.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a motion whenever it's appropriate to limit this delegation through the end of June 30th, 2017. Just make it for this that delegation for the purpose of extending and renewing these lines of credit at whatever the level is or somewhat lower, so that the board has an opportunity sometime before July 1, 2017 to review the process and decide whether they want to extend that for a further year.
Okay. Further discussion? Anybody? Corbett, you have a question?
I just think we're under constraints from the FTA at this point in time, and I think it's a board oversight function that the board should look at this exercise of lines of credit and do it on some regular basis rather than delegating this indefinitely to the general manager and the chief financial officer. I just think it's a matter of our oversight responsibility with the current state of financial well-being of the authority.
Perhaps we didn't understand you, Dennis. You want to explain to him your rationale for this, because I don't think it rises to this level.
So currently we come to the board, and my understanding is, and this has been the experience since I've been here, the board considers this a perfunctory exercise. You've always approved the extensions since it's required for operations. What we try to do, in a sense, to be far more disciplined about this is do two things. One is to reduce the overall cap. The aggregate cap is going down. Secondly, because of the rigid nature of how this is structured, WMATA loses annually on the opportunities to take advantage of market positions and renegotiate to the benefit of WMATA. What we're attempting to do in this case is to better position WMATA with respect to those kinds of decisions. But if the board chooses to make these decisions the way you've made it in the past, we will move forward based on those.
Okay, so the way we'll handle this is I'll take any further questions on the resolution before us. I'll move that resolution. Michael, if you choose to, you can make an amendment to it. We can discuss that, vote it up or down, and move forward. So is there any further discussion on the resolution that is before us? Tony, you had something.
Thanks. Dennis, I'm looking at your chart. At 1.14, the LLC capacity was at 150. And your proposal is to move from 300 to 250 while showing pretty dramatic reductions in balances. So can you explain to me why we wouldn't be capping at a lower amount, the LOC capacity at a lower amount, closer to 150 rather than 250?
The analysis that we've done over the last few months that led up to this recommendation is based on, obviously, our expectations of what the expenses have been, what experiences have been, and what we see coming down in the near term. One of the reasons why we are going beyond the 150 is because you have a larger capital program, you have a far more aggressive delivery strategies, and at some point, and if you recall, all of these lines have been used primarily to support the capital program. So if we go at the 150 at this point, given our recent experiences, there is a strong likelihood that I will be back here asking you for an additional flexibility sometime soon. But as we go forward over the next few months and years, we may be in a position to get a better experience and therefore be in a better position to reduce the values.
So in essence, the orange bar balances are on the existing debt, and you just want the flexibility to come back and use more of that capacity, which would obviously increase the balance.
Correct, as we try to realign the capital structure.
Thank you.
Further, more. Yeah. Before we act on this at the board level, could we see the cash flow analysis that will support the going forward positions? I know we see that regularly, but I'd like to have it before we decide finally on this approach.
Absolutely, and obviously we provide that on a monthly basis to you, and I believe we just did that also this week.
Okay. Anything further? Okay. I'd like to move the resolution for the renewal of the lines of credit. Is there a second? Okay. Is there any further discussion on it? Yes.
Make a motion.
I'm not sure if I'm understanding what Mort's request was. You want to delay action until
you
see the cash flow
analysis?
No, I
just want to see it before we actually act at the board.
So we'll the board move on it today and then in the interim period to get the information. Do you want to make your amendment or not?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
The amendment is that a resolution line that says this delegation authorization shall expire June 30th, 2017.
Okay, the amendment has been made to the resolution. Is there any discussion, further discussion, any discussion? Kathy?
I'm a little bit concerned about doing that. I just worry that the board may get caught up in some major issue that happens and we may not get to it in time, and that would leave us in a very, very difficult position vis-a-vis our lines of credit. But I do agree with the concern that you have, which is that the board needs to be more involved in these kinds of financial issues. And I wonder if it would be acceptable to substitute, well, I'm going to propose to substitute for your amendment, an amendment that require that says that the does not limit the ability of the three individuals to negotiate, but that says by the end of the fiscal year, before the end of the fiscal year, we have to be briefed on any decisions that are upcoming that either any of those individuals intend to make. So it mandates that the board gets briefed at that point, and if we choose to move forward and do something at that point, we can. I just worry about putting a time limit on it now, that something could happen, we could get caught up, and we could put the authority in a difficult position.
Well, before we do anything, I failed to ask for a second for your motion.
So we'll make that a part of the budget adoption.
So, wait, Mort, before you made your motion, your amendment, I failed to ask for a second. So is there a second to Michael's amendment?
I'll second Michael's amendment.
Okay. So he's moved and seconded, and then you have Kathy.
This would be a substitute, I think, which would not limit the authority, but would mandate that there be the board has to come back to it before the end of the fiscal year.
Okay, and you're accepting that as a friendly amendment to your amendment, and then Mort, you had a comment?
No, I said that would neatly fall into the budget adoption for the following year.
Okay. Is there further discussion on the Kathy's amendment to Michael's amendment to the resolution?
So your amendment is for a continued approval?
So that the...
At the end of the year?
The mechanism in the resolution now continues, that the approval is indefinite. But there's an additional required re-examination or re-action by the board by the end of this fiscal year, on the same time frame that Michael proposed. But it's a mandated board review rather than a limitation of the authority.
And the understanding of that, might I ask?
Go ahead, yes.
The understanding of that, does that continually allow the staff to look at the conditions where we are so that we go out to the market or whatever we need to continue to be able to have the revenue that we want and make the decisions that we want without being hampered by a time frame?
The way I'm putting it, there are no conditions. In other words, I'm not saying that they can't move forward, but this would give the board an opportunity. If there was a specific concern that the board had, the board could take an action at that point, if it chose to. But it could say, you know, we just want to move forward.
I just wanted to, may I clarify my
position? Yes, go ahead.
Position? My point being, that is your, and I think I understand that, but...
Can you speak into your mic?
I'm sorry. But I really do want what the staff has presented to us in terms of why they're asking for this, that this does not hamper them at all. I do agree with you, and I
Paul,
like
does
that confirmation.
And then I'll go to Christian. Paul, does this hamper, or Dennis, does this hamper?
What I was thinking is what we could do is in the quarterly financial updates, we'll just tell you exactly what we've been doing. You can monitor it on an ongoing basis to see where we are, and that gives us the flexibility. And if you see something you don't like, then you can come back and do something, you know, different.
Okay, Christian. Okay, back to...
That was my comment as well.
All right, well, we do have something in front of us to vote on, so what are we doing now? Do we want to vote on this? And is it acceptable to you guys what they put out there? Yes?
Yes.
Okay. All right. The motion made by Michael and amended by Kathy is before us. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Okay. The ayes. Yes, Jim?
Maybe I'm not understanding it, but are we revisiting it or are we getting quarterly updates?
My understanding is you're giving us the flexibility to go up to $250 million, basically just to manage the program that way, and we will quarterly tell you what we're doing in terms of going up or down on that $250.
So that would be different, though, than what – is that different than what, Kathy, what you
no,
proposed?
No, I'm trying to address the specific concern that Michael brought up, that the board needs to be involved in understanding what's going on. And
okay.
I would be okay if that comes in the form of a quarterly update.
Yeah.
But I just want to make sure that the board does get that update around the end of the fiscal year.
Okay. Jim, are you okay with that?
I like the quarterly updates, that we receive quarterly updates.
Okay.
Okay, and just leave it at that. We receive quarterly updates.
Okay.
We already have the responsibility to manage that.
Okay. We all good with that?
I'm okay with
yes.
it.
Yes. All right. Everybody understands what we're doing? Okay. Again, why don't you vote on it again? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, have it. The ayes have it. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, then don't we have to vote on the underlying resolution?
I think that's
I thought your amendment was a friendly amendment to his
it
amendment.
It was, but we voted on the amendment. Did we
okay,
have to
we'll
vote,
vote
on
again.
The
sure. Why not? We'll vote again. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, have it. Ayes have it. Okay. Thank you. Our next item is the approval of revisions to the drug and alcohol policy and review updated procedures manual. I think this time I'm going to move it and then we'll have the discussion. Maybe I'll do that. So I'd like to move the approval of revisions to drug, alcohol policy and review of updated procedures manual. Is there a second?
Second.
Second. Okay. Discussion start with whoever's going to discuss this.
Okay, thank you. Today I would like to provide an overview and request board adoption of Metro's revised drug and alcohol policy and testing program, as well as present Metro's new drug and alcohol procedures manual. Before I get started, I would like to introduce and recognize my colleague Mike Reese, from the Office of General Counsel. He, along with Michael Duncan, Director of Compensation Benefits and Medical Services, did a great deal of the heavy lifting to get us to this point, so I wanted to recognize him. In 1994, Metro's board originally adopted the Drug and Alcohol Testing Program, which incorporates the USDOT and FTA guidelines on drug and alcohol misuse, prevention, and testing. The policy has undergone periodic revisions since that time to comply with the regulatory changes, most recently in 2015. The policy covers all Metro employees, applicants for employment, and employees of Metro contractors and subcontractors performing safety-sensitive work as defined by DOT and FTA regulations or Metro policy. The policy includes the categories of testing, confirmatory levels for drug and alcohol, testing collection procedures, consequences, positive tests, reporting and record retention, as well as information regarding Metro's drug and alcohol education and training program. When the FTA conducted their triennial review in 2014, a corrective action was issued requiring Metro to provide FTA with an amended drug and alcohol policy adopted by the board. It incorporated three findings at that time, all of which were practices. They just wanted to see them incorporated into the policy. In 2015, the FTA conducted a more comprehensive drug and alcohol compliance audit. That resulted in 9 new findings regarding the policy. In January of this year, Metro provided a revised draft policy to the FTA for review, and I'm pleased to report that the FTA has responded that the revised draft policy before you addresses the 2015 audit findings and is in compliance with the DOT FTA regulations. The revised policy addresses the findings by providing additional detail for certain testing requirements and clarifying FTA versus Metro mandated testing requirements in the policy. The incorporation of these requirements into the revised policy documented, again, well-established practices by Metro that comply with the regulations. They just were not codified in the policy. And I'm also pleased to report that nothing here increased the cost of the program. The draft policy includes several additional revisions that, while not required by the FTA, clarify drug and alcohol standards, such as further detailing Metro's prescription and over-the-counter medication procedures and providing more discretion to the applicable on-site investigator regarding whether or not an employee must undergo a Metro post-incident drug and alcohol test. You may recall during the board adoption of the revised policy following the triennial review that management informed the board at that time that Metro would benefit by the documentation of certain additional procedures to ensure the effective implementation of the revised policy. At that time, the board directed the staff to proceed with the development of those procedures. Staff comprised of representatives from procurement, rail, bus, and labor in collaboration with council and HR have established a 113-page living document of meaningful desk procedures in a drug and alcohol manual to ensure proper implementation of the policy by consolidating and memorializing Metro's drug and alcohol procedures related to the end-to-end drug and alcohol testing process, the determination, tracking, storage, updating, and maintenance of the list of safety-sensitive positions that are subject to testing, Metro's drug and alcohol oversight of contractors, ensuring uniform adherence across all departments throughout Metro to meet our drug and alcohol testing program obligations, and then policy distribution to all employees. So we're respectfully requesting approval and adoption of the policy. And we'd be happy to entertain any questions you might have.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there any questions, any discussion? Mort?
Last year when we spoke about this was one of several areas within WMATA practice where compliance with federal regulations was under a certain amount of review. And we felt in this one we needed to both update the policy and follow through to see that it's being done in practice. And I'm just going to ask Paul whether the effort is continuing with respect to other federal mandates.
Excuse me. It is. In fact, we're on the FMO, the next presentation, we're going to get into where we're on those, if that's your thing.
Okay. Further? Okay. Now, we've already moved and seconded it, so we've already had discussions. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. Okay, thank you very much. Our next is an informational item, and it's the Financial Management Oversight Report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning to you and the members of the committee. Our purpose for this item today is to provide you with information on WMATA's progress in addressing deliverable expectations of the FTA Financial Management or FMO, Financial Management Oversight or FMO Testing and Validation Plan. FTA's FMO Testing and Validation Plan, dated September 30, 2015, transitioned WMATA into the validation and possible closeout stage of the findings noted in the June 10, 2014 FMO report. As previously discussed with the committee, the plan expressed FTA's objective of validating that WMATA implemented all the corrective actions necessary to address the material weaknesses and the significant deficiencies identified during the FMO review. You may recall that the plan includes 20 action items. These 20 action items are grouped into three categories, which include WMATA deliverables from October 2015 through December 2016. The visual representation of the plan shown above provides you an alignment of the 65 corrective action plans originally provided by WMATA to the 20 action items that are stated in the September 30th validation and testing plan. It is important to note that we do not have a one-for-one relationship, again, with these, with WMATA's corrective action plans and the action items noted in the September 30th, 2015 action plan. It is also important to know that there are some items that do not specifically relate to the FMO review of 2014. However, they were identified and deemed important by the FTA. There are also some WMATA caps, as previously stated, that will not require an FMO FTA follow-up review. The next slide provides you with the current status of WMATA's deliverable items. As of December 31st, 2015, 14 of the 20 action items noted here were submitted to the FTA on time. You may also note that we had one deliverable item due in January, which was also submitted on time. This item was actually related to FTA-funded assets. Again, it was submitted on time. We have one deliverable item due to FTA in March, and that is planned for on-time delivery to the FTA. It is important to note that as we work through the deliverable items of these plans, we continue to ensure that we meet the deadlines with no exceptions. The next slide provides you with the status of the deliverable items. Just to talk about this in some detail, our first set of items were due to the FTA on the 31st of October. Sometime after that, around November, FTA started evaluation of the submittals. Our October deliverables were provided to FTA, and they primarily included documentation requirements. These included documentation around the identification and mapping of labor draw costs, the policies and procedures around WMATA's correct calculation and application of the fringe benefit costs, as well as information required for the milestone progress report for FTA-funded projects. WMATA received FTA's formal response to the October deliverables on December 8, 2015, with a request to make minor adjustments to WMATA's submissions. FTA's validation of the November submissions started sometime in December with a procurement process, as well as a review of the financial management access controls. In addition to the analysis started in December, FTA conducted on-site reviews from January 5th to January 8th, 2016. Based on the validation plan, which is in fact an estimate, we expect to have FTA complete the FTA-funded asset reviews or initiate it sometime around February, as well as initiate the procurement job audit contract reviews sometime around April. Again, an estimate based on the plan. WMATA continues to work towards the FTA, work with the FTA, rather, on the financial management oversight plan expectations, as well as its deliverables. We plan to support the FTA's financial management oversight contractor, as well as ensure that all expectations and the objectives of on-site and off-site tests and validations are met. Now I'd like to talk a little bit about the internal control reviews conducted by the Office of Internal Controls. The February 5th quarterly compliance board oversight matrix report included a status of internal control reviews completed through December 31st, 2015. The report contained details, including the review objectives, the scope of the review, and the results of management's action through December 31st, 2015. This included 9 reviews that were in progress at that time. You may have also noted that our information provided on February 5th included the confirmation that 5 reviews were concluded in December as well. Our office continues to conduct targeted review procedures based on FDA's validation and testing plan. This is focused on assessing WMATA's readiness for validation and testing by FDA. Audit readiness reviews were initiated for FDA-funded assets with a focus on property transactions and the required biannual inventory. We also conducted an audit readiness review for the compliance with the audit closeout policy here at WMATA. In addition to the audit readiness reviews that have been conducted, we continue FMO cap follow-up efforts with a review of the HR and payroll controls. We also initiated 3 specific labor draw reviews with the objective of providing reasonable assurance that the direct labor costs associated with recent FCA draw requests are supportable by WMATA's records and that the costs have been charged to the same activity for which work was performed. Finally, our office has also started preliminary review efforts associated with unauthorized commitments. This has the objective of determining whether management is complying with the policies and procedures related to budgeting as an operational control for planned expenditures. In terms of our next steps, staff will continue to work towards meeting the deliverable expectations of FTA's FMO testing and validation plan. As mentioned before, we have 1 deliverable item due in March, and we are planned to provide this on time to FTA. Our office will continue to complete compliance monitoring activities. This would, of course, include reviews that are scheduled, as well as assessments of financial management controls. In support of the overall compliance effort, our office will also continue to identify opportunities for training similar to the 6 allowable cost compliance training sessions that were provided to staff with grants management responsibility back in November. Mr. Chairman, this completes the update for this month, and at this time, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Questions from anyone? Harriet?
I just have a suggestion. I realize that complying with the FMO recommendations and being timely is very important, and whether or not we can get our money in a timely way is dependent on that. But I feel that this presentation somewhat plays into one of the shortcomings maybe here at WMATA, that we check a lot of boxes and we focus a lot on procedure, and it's kind of hard to, having sat through that presentation, to have gotten the substance of what is better at WMATA, what is better with respect to our financial management than before. We did a review. We did an audit. And so, you know, I'm not suggesting you start all over, but I am suggesting that in future presentations that we try to answer the question, and so what, when we talk about these things. And so what is different? Because, you know, in our other management reviews that we're doing, we're getting quite a very vivid picture of the conditions of some of our accounting, and that I'm feeling the cognitive dissonance of it, and I would just like to have a little bit more of the substance about what this does. And again, the answer might be being ready to be audited is a big step forward, even if the audit finds that there are significant shortcomings. So even that would be helpful as the so what, right? So anyway, just a thought. I appreciate how important it is to meet the deadlines and that you're on it. But for the board members and for the people who listen in, a little bit more of that might be helpful.
Okay, thank you. Mort?
Yeah, I just want to go back to the point I made before. Compliance with the FMO is one package of federal requirements. Drug and alcohol is another. I'm just looking at the long list. It's, I hate to say it, 65 pages of things that we are required to certify that we are doing as a matter of federal law. and I think we need to revisit those to be sure we're comfortable issuing the certificate. Everything from lead-based paint to employment practices to service issues. I'd hate to have us wake up one morning and again find we haven't been in compliance with requirements that we knew were there, and I think we should take that seriously.
Okay. All right, thank you very much. We're going to our next item, which is the FY 2016 second quarter financial update.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Our goal today is to update the committee on Metro's operating and capital budget performance through December 2015. I will discuss the operating budget results while my colleague Andy Off will update the committee on Metro's capital investment activities through the same period. Ridership through the first half of FY16 is down 5.4% for a variety of reasons, of course, compared to last year. And based on that lower ridership trend, total passenger fares as well as parking fee revenues are below budget through December of 2015. When you look at the numbers, year-to-date operating expenses and revenues were $849 and $447 million, respectively. Overall, operating revenues is unfavorable to budget by $16 million, primarily due to lower ridership. On the other hand, operating expenses is $48 million favorable to budget, driven by lower staffing, services, and energy costs. As a result, Metro is $32 million positive to budget, with a cost recovery ratio that's 1 percentage point better than budget. As indicated by the arrows, ridership is down across all modes versus budget. For the year, ridership is at 164.2 million trips, which is about 10 million below target. Again, as a result, overall revenue is down, as I mentioned a little bit earlier. When you look at the operating cost details, tight control of non-critical, non-safety sensitive positions over time, as well as the elimination of the contribution to OPEB, has helped to hold costs down. On the non-personnel side, all cost categories are below budget, except for materials and supplies, which is over by $5 million, and that is attributable to the increased maintenance activities with respect to rail cars and buses. Post-December 31, Metro has faced additional risks with respect to the FY16 operating budget. As a result of both the lower ridership as well as the January snowstorms, which over 5 days is estimated to have cost Metro $14 million, $8 million of which on lower revenues and $6 million of increased operating cost. In response, the GM has directed staff to identify additional actions that needs to be taken to ensure that Metro ends the year with a balanced budget. With that, Mr. Chairman, I will turn it over to Andy to describe the capital program.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Dennis. Good morning. Through 31 December 2015, or the end of our second quarter, we have invested $416 million against our approved budget of $1.2 billion, noting 34% expense to date, although not good by any reasonable measure relative to fiscal year 2015, it is an improvement where at the same point last year, we were at roughly 25%. Next. Vehicles and vehicle parts. We continue to do very well on our bus rehabilitation and bus replacement programs. We fully expect to rehabilitate 100 and replace 165 buses this year. On the 1000 series rail car replacement project, our glide path is headed in the correct direction. In the month of February, we accepted 8 rail cars, which is the first month that we've ever accepted more than 4. We've already accepted 4 in the month of February, fully expect to accept at least 8 in the month of February. And as of next Monday, we will have 10 7,000 series 8-car trains serving customers in the system. Next is some of our systems and technology programs, primarily on the traction power side. We continue to make good progress on our tiebreaker and traction power rehabilitation programs. We did divert some funds and needed to defer some work in order to address the events at the Stadium Armory traction power substation. And we have also completed all of our, what's referred to as our Orange Boot rehabilitation work as part of the NTSB findings on the red line. Next. Maintenance facilities, CIP 85, which is a Royal Street bus garage, and CIP 84, also a bus garage. We are finally out of the ground. Permits are behind us. We're making progress. However, we do not expect to fully expend all budget authority on those two projects, but we are moving in the right direction. And the risk here noted is the purchase of warehouse facilities. The decisions have recently been made, and we will be moving forward on acquisitions to acquire property in support of that program. Passenger facilities, our elevator and escalator program continues to do well. We have some major programs that will begin in March. And the Tiger program is proceeding well, and we do not expect to have any challenges, and we will meet our grant requirements of that specific Tiger grant. Next is track and structures. The numbers are there. We continue to, you know, meet our annual goals. We are on target to replace the amount of rail as planned, to weld as the number of joints as planned, and the other track components within the system. Next. Our line contracts, we have the bid for a Red Line 2 project, and that is currently under consideration. We continue to move forward specifically on the NTSB finding with our track circuit project. That continues well. And our orange-blue line contract, which we are continuing to evaluate to find more and, you know, better effective ways to put that work in place. Next is some of our smaller projects. The Carmen Turner upgrades complete. No issues on this specific portfolio. Maintenance equipment, we're in the closeout of this. This portfolio also includes the radio project. We are continuing to make very good progress, although our spending is not where we thought it would be. You know, as we learn, we're simply, you know, producing more with less, not due to any constraint other than we're finding that we're able to put up more of the equipment with the manpower we do have as opposed to what some of our projections were. Next. And I will be back next in May to provide another update. Looking forward, we're currently in the process of updating our FY16 forecasts. As of today, we expect to end the year at around $985 million in investments relative to a budget of $1.2 billion, which would put us at roughly 80% expense. Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you very much for your report. There's a lot of good information there, but obviously the big issue is ridership is down. And I just wanted to start by reading you a text I got at 8:54 this morning from a longtime friend who is a senior person in the district government. It's entitled, "Why Metro Lost Me. Rode the Red Line for 8 years. Tried again this morning from Friendship Heights. No 8-car trains, 10 minutes between trains. When the cars are packed at Friendship Heights in morning rush, that means trouble opening and closing doors at every inbound stop to Metro Center. A bad ride, maybe a train out of service. Why no 8-car trains? Why 10 minutes between trains? Service should be getting better, not demonstrably worse. I bailed. I'm in my car. Cheers." Kind of says it all. So, Paul, the question we're all going to get today is ridership is down a lot. What are we going to do to stem the
ridership falling? What are we doing to add people back? Give us your best thoughts on all of this.
Sure. I mean, it's interesting. I read the red line this morning as well, and it was I read the red line this morning as well, and it was on 3 minute headway. So it does go up and down as things occur for sure. And I got off of, this morning I got off a MARC train with, thousands of people, and the system worked very well. But the key for us on the service liability, obviously the 7000 series, getting those cars in. Andy just gave an update on that. The other is on car maintenance. Basically, there's three issues that we face: propulsion, brakes, and doors. I've got some outside people coming in to basically look at how we've been doing that. What else is there we can do to drive those numbers down? Because that drives car availability, which drives the ability to go to 8 trains and or shorten the headways. So that's the key in the short term, is to get as many of the cars that we have, on property out every morning. So that's my focus. That's how we solve that issue. There will always be issues that pop up, and we have to manage those as quickly as we can. But if we don't have the fleet out there, we're just starting from behind, and that's what this gentleman or woman referenced, if that's what occurred. Although I do know when I got on at, this was 6:30-ish, whatever time frame, we were at those headways. So maybe something occurred. I wasn't following it
at the time. And following up on that, I think maybe everybody got one of these texts. There was a gate's not open at one of the Yeah, and so what happened? I mean, I saw the picture, and I don't want to make light of it, but it looked like in Titanic with the people at the steerage trying to get through the gates that were locked.
Right, there was something with the chain that they kept it locked, and they couldn't get undone, so we had to get people to go into the other entrance. As we sent people out there, I guess with bolt cutters, it's fixed. But I'm saying, is that what we did? Send bolt cutters out there, cut the chain out. So it was just one of these squirrely things that will occur every now and then.
Okay.
I don't know the details of what exactly why that train was blocking it, but that's what the issue was.
Okay, so we'll go around. We'll start with Tony. Just go around. Tony, go ahead.
Thank you for the report. I did also ride the red line this morning, and from Tacoma down to Judiciary Square, and I had no problem. In fact, I got here earlier than I normally get, so it does work, and it does go good and bad depending on the situation with the cars. I'd like to find out at some point whether we can develop any models to say how much the transit benefit impacted on ridership, the lack of it for a period of time, whether we can finitely tell we lost so much ridership because of the transit benefit. So that's something I'm concerned about. The second thing is related to the capital program. I'm looking at the investment to date as of 31 December 2015. And one of the big ticket items is maintenance facilities at $193 million. It only percent spent is 19%. That's a big item, and I'm a little concerned about that issue. But looking at the whole capital program, is there actually one or two major projects that you're monitoring very closely of concern that we may not be able to execute properly or is being delayed for some reason? I mean, are we getting to the management level where we're looking at some big projects that have big dollar values associated with them that will not be executable this year?
Yes, we are. I think I mentioned before, I've started a process where I'm reviewing every project, every capital project, to monitor what's going on in terms of both budget and schedule. So there, every project will have its issue. And then what we'll do is we'll, in effect, quarterly, we'll start to identify what those are for you so you understand those. So we know what's coming up next on some of these projects, because they have some issues that are going to slow them down. Others we may want to try to speed up.
Okay, I just want to be reassured that we're doing that kind of analysis and looking at the ultimate percentage spent at the end of the fiscal year. On the surface, a lot of people would think, well, we should be at 50%. Right. But as someone who's come from the construction field, I know that's not how money is expended. And it looks like we're certainly much better than we were last year at this time when you look at the total budget. So that's a positive sign. But again, I don't know the previous years from that, so that would be something you may want to look at.
Actually, we have. We've been in the 75% burn rate for the last 5 years. I think, did I ask for 10 years? Yeah, I asked for 10 years. I'll be talking more to you about that issue.
Christian, do you have anything?
Sure. I just would, as you are putting together, particularly on the capital side, the presentation of the financial impact, but as Paul mentioned, the importance of the deliverable and what those are. I mean, you got like big, broad categories here of what the deliverables are, but that they are actually being delivered, that they're being done so on budget, and not just about the money that's being spent, but how the money is being spent, whether or not it's being spent on overruns or change orders and all those kinds of things. I mean, from a global sense, it would be very helpful to know that we are making that progress on those things. The other thing that is on here that I think these things work together, which is this track rehabilitation issue and understanding where the light at the end of the tunnel is for that. Where is the light at the end of the tunnel on track rehabilitation? Because that's going to negatively impact the riders. I think that there's a real correlation between those headways, those longer headways, and getting people out of the system. They've given up on us. We have to change that. We have to show people that there's a light at the end of the tunnel, that they can then say, okay, you're making these investments. We know what it's going to be, how long it's going to take, when we will be done with that, and that we're going to be able to get to a service level that people are comfortable with. And I think that will help bring people back on the operational side. I just want to make sure that we're making that presentation and letting people know that that's something that we're doing.
Okay, Tony.
A couple questions. Actually, follow up on a couple of issues Tony brought up on the transit benefit. Slow customer response to change in transit benefit, I'm assuming, is a risk, not a benefit. That's kind of knowable. For instance, General Services Administration, transit benefits kick in on March 1. I think if you all talk to the other agencies, you'll get an idea of when those transit benefits kick in, so it won't be a mystery. So I encourage y'all to do that. And then, Tony, I think we did get those numbers from the standpoint of the impact of the transit benefit and reduction in ridership. I think folks did a pretty good analysis of what that looks like. We can re-up those numbers.
If I could, the next presentation on the work session for 17, we have a little bit more detail on that whole transit benefit program.
One suggestion for a couple of comments on spend forecasting. It sounds like we're looking at 80% for the overall program. One thing that I'm used to, because I've done a lot of construction management and project management, is I think it'd be helpful to not only understand, I'm assuming to be spent in these charts means budgeted, but by the end of second quarter, you have a pretty decent idea of where you're going to end up in each of these items. So I think it'd be helpful to us to actually know where you think projected end of year spending will be in some chunkable way. I mean, and maybe it's the same bar charts that you're giving us. Because right now it just feels like it's a mystery. It's kind of, well, we might get what we budgeted, but you'd know where we're going to be. And it is chunky. And so if we have that information, we'll know, hey, you're going to catch up in the last 6 months because there's going to be a big award or something like that, a big delivery. So I think it'd be really useful to have that information.
That's one of the things that I've asked Andy and his team to provide to me, so I'm starting to get that. So we'll incorporate it into future presentations on this.
Thank you.
Harriet.
Tom. Just to pick up on what Tony says, it takes HR, in many cases, a couple months to trigger the transit benefit through the system. So since the president signed this tax extender thing that I personally worked on in December, meant January was off, was not going to happen in January. And then February was in play. So you're right, Tony, about the lag. And that's what's happening around the country, not just here in the Washington metropolitan area. So just to make a clarification.
Kathy.
First of all, I want to agree with the point that Tony made about we have we sort of know what our spend rate and our end point is going to be. The other point along with that is that I think on one of them, and I forget which it is, you mentioned that we weren't going to spend all of the budgeted money because we had found a way to be more efficient and we didn't need to spend all of the money. That's good news. It sort of got ignored in the overall thing. So if you could figure out a way both to accommodate Tony's comment and also to indicate if it looks like we don't actually need that much money. I mean, we're spending the money because we want to get the stuff done, not because we want to get rid of the money. So if it turns out that we're saving money, that would be a good piece of news. But I think I wanted to fundamentally agree with what Malcolm said. This is very good from a management perspective, but just as we did with dealing with passenger time through the system as a way of looking at it from a customer perspective, it would be good to figure out the customer perspective for this. And I think what Malcolm spoke about is the way of doing that. That, you know, instead of saying, well, we've spent X percent of the money that we budgeted, say, well, like the escalator elevators, looks like it's pretty good news because it looks like we've spent about half of what we've done. And so can we say, you know, of the escalator elevators we were planning to do this year, we've done half of them by halfway through the year. That would be a really good piece of information if I'm, you know, confronting a non-working escalator to think, well, you know, we are actually making progress on this. And that's just sort of another way to think about how we present it, because in terms of this is good from a management perspective, from a customer perspective, understanding where all that money is going. I think that would be a really good idea to do something like what Malcolm suggested.
Jim.
Thank you, Jack. And I also want to play a little bit on what Malcolm and Kathy have been saying. And Dennis, going back to your numbers, down 5.4% again in ridership through December, so over 5 months. And I do like to think a lot of that may have had to do with the transformer issue, because you could not depend on. So my real question is, do we track the incidents? I know we had the smoke incident in January of last year. How much decline did we have during that time where there was zero reliability as far as when your train was going to arrive with the transformer issue, which I guess was really mostly September, October, November? If I have that correct in my head, and Paul, so we can get some figures on that. And Paul, I'd like to ask you also, and maybe it falls under Lynn Bowersock's in the communications piece. Our customers, our riders, have lost faith in the system. There's no question about that. What are we going to do to redo that? I can order a pizza, and if it's not there in a certain amount of time, I get it for free. Is there something like that I can do when I'm riding on the weekends? Our ridership is so off on weekends. Is there something we can do to make consumers feel that we have them at heart? And I think our riders feel abandoned by the system. And what are we going to do to communicate with them? And I know we have a great app. I know we have a lot of information, but I don't think that they believe that we have their best interests at heart now. I think we do, but I don't think we're conveying that. So what can we do from a communication standpoint? What you did offering free rides the Monday after the blizzard was a major win for this organization. What can we do to capitalize on that with other things? That was good customer service, and I think we need more of that.
I totally agree. I will be, there are a number of things I'm about to do that I think will get to the very issue. I wanted to share some of those with you in closed session before they go public, just so you're aware of those.
I have a couple of questions, but I first want to just express a rant and a frustration, because in the 2 years that I've been here, each month we've reported on the decline in traffic and the decline in revenue, which has been going on since 2008, 2009, and as your report indicates, we're now at ridership levels that are 10 years old, ridership levels we experienced back in December 2004, I think was the number in your report.
And we seem to have adopted the belief that if we only get more reliable, if we only fix reliability, traffic will rebound again and go taking off again. And Tom has the great belief that now that we have the transit benefit, it'll turn around and we'll go skyrocketing again. But the numbers don't seem to bear that out. The decline in traffic began in 2008, 2009, and the deterioration in service, your report points to a time in 2014 where we were beginning to gear up for the Silver Line, stealing trains from other places to do that. And certainly we had transit benefit for most of this 10-year period. Certainly the transit benefit was there in 2008, 2009, and traffic... No, but it was at a level. It's come back up. It's now higher than it was before. But it was higher before, then it came down, and now it's higher up again. My own point is that I don't think we really know why traffic is falling. And I would encourage the general manager, with the authority he has, to let a contract to some outside experts who can look into this, do a deep dive, and figure out why has traffic declined so precipitously over the past 5 years, and why has it declined to levels that we haven't experienced since 2004? There's a lot of theories out there, you know, federal government downsizing, sequestration, telemarketing, biking, use of Uber and Lyft, decline in gas prices, but let's let somebody who's impartial outside, you know, George Mason University has a transportation function, there's plenty of think tanks on transportation in D.C. You know, Brookings Institution is a very big metropolitan transportation practice. Let's get somebody a contract to look at this and give us some real information, take a look at it and find out if they can come up with an explanation of what's going on here, because that may affect how we want to move forward on the long term with this system. We may find out that we'll make all these changes and we'll be reliable, but traffic will still continue where it's been going. Let's find out. Now, I have three questions on the presentation. On the capital program investment to date, picking up on what I think Tony was saying, we're at 34% for half the year. Where would you expect, Andy, for some accelerated spending for the rest of the second half of 2016? I assume the assumption is that we're going to get close to 100%. We probably won't get there. But in order to get close to 100%, there's got to be some accelerated spending in some of these capital spending categories. Where would you suggest that we're going to see that accelerated spending in the second half of the year?
Sir, based upon our current projections, we see ourselves ending up at $985 million invested this fiscal year, which is roughly 80%, you know, of the approved $1.2 billion. So your question is, what about the 20% that you have identified that will not be invested?
No, that's not really my question. My question is, to get to there, where are we going to get those great increases as accelerated levels of spending in the second half of the year? Is it going to be delivery of train cars? Is it going to be something in maintenance facilities, which is now at 19% for the year? Where specifically is the acceleration going to be to get you to the 80%?
To the 80%, that's the issue that I've seen, is I don't think we're going to get there to the 100%, and that's what he's saying. But the larger projects that drive those numbers are, for instance, the 7,000 series. You know, those are big numbers. So if that slows down, it slows down. If that picks up, then we can pull in more of that, you know, get up above 80%. So there's a few larger projects like that, but it's a series of smaller ones that just either aren't flowing for whatever reason, some of it management, some of it just, you know, permitting, whatever. There's all kinds of issues that come into capital program that could slow something down. But, I mean, again, it's been a 10-year history of this. So I'm stepping back and taking a look at the whole program. Is, you know, what's realistic that we should even be committing to, you know, that, you know, based on what we've been able to deliver, either, again, for all types of reasons.
Well, on the 7,000 rail cars in particular, the budget plan says that the goal is delivery, 12 deliveries per month. I assume we're not at 12. Do we expect to get to 12 in the next 90 days? So that's an area of accelerated spending for the second half?
Exactly. The potential for it, given the scale of it. Until we have them coming off the line at the production rate that we can accept, you know, I can't commit to that.
So at this stage, we don't know when we're going to get the 12.
I cannot commit to that.
I just have one more question. On the chart on, I guess, passenger facilities, there was just a point of a traffic signal priority system. We indicate 20 intersections now have that. Where are those 20 intersections? Are any in Maryland? So it's a two-part question. Are we talking about just a district program, or are we talking about a program that's working in all the...
Can we get back to you on that? Just sure. Off the top of our heads. Thank you.
Marty? Yeah, I just add my view on progress in the capital program. From time to time, we have seen some powerful information that said, here's how much we have to do. Here's how much of it is reducing the backlog. Here's the time when we get to a steady state. We haven't seen that in a couple of years, but looking at what we have here, I think you ought to be capable of producing that again. Give the rider some sense as to when the incessant amount of catch-up gets done and will be held accountable for running a system and maintaining it at the same time. And the other report from the front, I came through Vienna this morning. I have never seen fewer cars in the parking lot in the 20 years that I've ridden out of that station. And it's not just a shift to the Silver Line. It's like within the last few weeks, has been just apparently an incredible drop-off.
Next, Kathy.
Just a comment, because I think one thing that Mr. Downey goes to is that the climb has always been, where is the authority at addressing on an ongoing basis only the state of good repair, a level of operational peace? And I think because, most importantly, because of the cars, we are really at deficit. And so getting to that point is going to be a hard one. But I agree that we do need to think about who our riders are today and why, because otherwise we will be looking backward in terms of what we're working toward by spending our dollars. There are many, many more options available to a rider than there were a year, 2 years, or 5 years ago. And we need to decide where is the transit rider as a pure transit rider, and then the occasional transit rider. And does that make up the ridership of us for today? I think the other part is we see the constant and changing of land development around this area, and that is probably the best way that we're going to be able to measure it. So I think that, but I think that what getting us to a state of good repair that is exactly doing the regular maintenance and moving forward is going to be so dependent upon getting those larger capital investments, such as the cars out with the gate. Yeah.
Paul, two quick comments, Mr. Chair. You know, you talked about reliability of service and train lengths. You know, the one comment I hear with frequent regularity is the fact that our service was actually taken away on the Blue Line. And really have lost a lot of people, you know, and I know there are trade-offs and those decisions were made, obviously, and hoping, you know, when the cars come in and, you know, we're able to get back to a state of service there. But there is one highlight. The ridership of Metro Way went up 10% over last year, and as the Arlington stations open, I think, that's going to be a positive thing, hopefully. But I'm also mindful of a story I heard on AMU this morning. You know, it seems like riders are just waiting for the system. You know, they have faith in it, that it will, they'll be there, but yet, you know, they want to see improvement. And, you know, that's the biggest thing. That was pretty clear in the story this morning.
Robert, anything? Christian, did you have something?
Yes, yeah, briefly. I wanted to underscore Mr. Goldman, who described it as a rant, but I thought was a really prescient point that you you started with, is really getting a full concept of what this ridership means and where the declines come from, in addition to the things that you mentioned, you know, teleworking and gas prices and all the rest. We're also looking at serious potential future issues which are going to affect ridership to the good and to the bad, what Virginia's doing with hot lanes on 66 and 395. But at the same time, there are going to be lots of investments in multimodal forms, which could bring people back to rail. So in addition to looking at where our ridership has gone, we also need to look at what the future looks like for our region with some degree of independent academic analysis. I'm not sure that it really needs to be centered from WMATA paying for that contract, but maybe looking at our regional partners, COG and the Transportation Planning Board, for example, that can really convene this kind of effort that also looks at what's going on here, but also other transit networks around the country as well. Because I think until we get a handle on it, it drives not only so many of our decisions, but the narrative about WMATA, that if we continue to focus on ridership solely as an issue of safety and reliability, which is certainly there, I'm not dismissing it, but that's a self-defeating narrative if we continue to always focus on that without the data which really tells us what's going on. So thank you for that contribution, and I hope we can figure out how to move forward with it.
Harriet?
I would just say that I think that WMATA actually has one of the best planning staffs, you know, of any transit agency in the country. And what planners do when there's a lot of uncertainty is that they consider scenarios. And so I think none of us at the table would say we know what the future of transportation is going to be with the proliferation of choices. But at the same time, there are real practical limits, right? We couldn't, 100% of our riders or 50% of our riders couldn't shift to drive alone or to even one of those other things because there just isn't the road capacity. What we're getting is more use out of the vehicles that are on the road because they're being used more frequently, but there's still a finite amount of road capacity. It might be interesting to ask your staff to look at some scenarios of future demand, some growth, some static, maybe a couple of different decline scenarios, and see what our options are under those circumstances, because there is a ton of uncertainty.
And if I could just add to that and to what Mr. Dorsey said, the Council of Government staff has done some scenario planning on transportation options, and I'm sure they could help with that. They also might be able to do, we have technical assistance relationships with the Transportation Planning Board, and they may be able to do a deeper dive on our ridership numbers without our going to an outside consultant. I mean, there's still money involved, but I don't think it would be the same amount.
Okay. I have two things. Dennis, in light of some conversations we had at the Audit Committee meeting today, this is the second quarter financial update. Now, when the quarter ends, do we go back and audit the quarter? Here's what I'm getting at. In order to make sure our audit is done timely this year, one of the ideas is at the end of every quarter, we go back and audit the quarter and make sure the quarter numbers are all ready so that we don't wait till the end of the year, but we actually do it quarter by quarter. Are we doing anything like that?
We are beginning that process in terms of a quarterly financial close.
Yes, quarter financial close, exactly.
To put us in a better position, yes. We're doing it internally, again, given where we've been. This, frankly, will be the first quarter we are going to do that, the December timeline. And extending that to conversations with external auditors is something that we have not done and that we intend to begin.
Okay, so we're beginning. We're doing it as opposed to focusing on the intend as opposed to we actually are. The first quarter is done, now the second quarter is done, so we should really be auditing the first quarter, so that'll be.
What I'm saying is obviously I need to work with the OIG and the external auditors
okay.
to get that was
get that process in place.
Correct.
Okay, because if we wait till the end of the year, it could prove problematic. This may be a little bit outside the committee, but I'm going to ask it anyway, because we're talking about ridership. What has happened, at least in my world, is things have changed from people complaining to me about the safety of the trains, like they're going to fall off the tracks or something, to their physical safety in the actual system itself. And people, again, are saying, I'm afraid to ride Metro. I don't want to go down into these dark stations because I'm scared. Paul, could you just give us 30 seconds, a minute? What, because this is a conversation that's happening everywhere big. What are we doing?
You're talking about the personal safety of the people.
Yes, security as opposed to the trains.
A number of things. We're working closely with the district, for instance.
Yeah.
We now have a police presence in our police operations center, every day from 2 o'clock until midnight, I believe, or, yeah, till midnight, just to make sure that coordination's going on. We are getting more officers out there. We're taking some off of other details, particularly revenue details that we have them. We're going to backfill that with some other resources to put armed officers out on the system. I want to increase the visibility of our officers on the system, both physically where they stand, where they patrol, but also even just physically what they look like. So we're moving ahead with that so that people can see them. You just see the presence. We're looking at also moving we're using different technologies. I think you went over to the state or the Safety Operations Center, where we're trying to do that so we can get ahead of these things before they occur. Obviously, we're trying to get the word out that if you do something, we can find you and we're going to get you, and we're going to, you know, do everything in our power to do that. We're working again with the district. We've reached out to the schools to get our people out there, just both police, but also just the operators, and just sort of explain, you know, behave when you're down there, particularly, you know, for school children. As they get out in the morning, it goes smoothly. You know, kids are kids. They've been pent up all day. They get out and they just do what kids do. We just want to make sure we're doing that. We're focusing on some schools where we've had issues, you know, and we're trying to do that as well, again, in cooperation with the district as well.
Okay. You mentioned, and it stuck with me because it's something we did in the district when we were having serious crime problems. Chief Ramsey at the time ordered every police car to turn on its lights all day long, because people said they didn't see the police cars. Well, they were there, but nobody saw them. But when they had the lights on, everybody saw them. And you mentioned our police officers in the stations. They blend in with everybody else. But if they all had orange jackets on, they'd say, oh, God, there's a police presence here, and I didn't even know it was here. I'm not recommending orange jackets or whatever. But what is that, the perception that people are there, as opposed to the fact that right now you look and you can't tell who's there?
Yeah, no, that's a guy we've actually in the...
And we're doing something like that?
Final stages of procurement of...
okay, what do you know what it is we're going to do? Are we going to wear orange jackets or something?
In effect, a yellow, very yellow, bright yellow, above the, you know, above the waist type of thing, or above the chest, I guess, high. Just to prove that.
And we should make it that public that we're doing that, that people are out there, that when you walk into a station, you're going to see this visibility, something like
Can
that.
Can I just jump on that?
Yeah, Carrie,
in terms of
ahead.
Deterrence effect, when I talked to the manager of the Atlanta system, he talked about this specifically. He actually extended that practice to everyone, every WMATA employee who was going to be in a station or on the train. I mean, tons of our WMATA employees are on the trains all the time, but they do a little bit blend in. They're not visible in that same way. If they had the same kind of bright yellow vests, you know, when they're in the system, on the platforms, anywhere in, you know, that I think would also have an amazing deterrence effect, and it wouldn't cost anything to do that.
I agree.
Okay, anything further before we wrap up? Tom, yes, go ahead.
We had a meeting, Corbett and myself, with Police Chief. One of the ideas that Paul, you probably just didn't mention it but not forgot, was to convene a meeting with high-intense station managers to get their input at the stations that have the highest incidence problem areas. Because I think they're front line, and they may have some ideas that we just don't know about.
Okay. All right. We'll move on to the next item, since we're way behind here, the FY 2017 budget workshop.
Mr. Chairman, today's budget discussions will focus on outstanding questions from board members with respect to the FY 17 proposed budget. We will also update the committee regarding expenses and revenues, including a five-year outlook, and then discuss the status of the capital funding grant agreement extension. We will start with a brief reminder of the FY17 budget principles, including the GM's top priorities, which are shown on the top left quadrant of the slide above. Ensuring system safety, improving service reliability, and enhancing fiscal accountability across WMATA. On the top right-hand side of the slide, we've also listed Metro's commitment to riders under jurisdiction. No fare increases, no service reductions, and no increase in jurisdictional subsidy in FY17. Now shifting to outstanding board questions. This table shows how Metro's fares for long-distance rail trips compared to similar trips within the Washington region. As you can see, Metro's single-trip fares are lower. The weekly pass is generally comparable, but the monthly pass is higher. This is one area and one reason why the Name Your Own Value Pass pilot, which is being started fairly soon, this is one of the areas that is designed to address, and we expect that the options that it will provide to potential customers at the longer end of the cost curve will be an advantage that hopefully they'll take care of. Nationally, this table provides a similar comparison for trips of similar length on other commuter rail systems outside of this region using the 12.5-mile trip from Franconia Springfield to Union Station, as well as similar trips on VRE. As the previous example indicates, Metro's single trip fare, again, is lower. The weekly pass, again, is roughly equal, and the monthly pass is higher. The next question that we received is respect to customers who reload their smart trip cards on Metro Bus. In the last 10 years, average bus fees have declined region-wide, and the cost of providing the same frequency of service has increased significantly. So this initiative, along with the traffic signal priority question that was asked a little bit earlier, dedicated bus lanes and reducing the number of stops, all seek to improve the speed of Metro Bus. And if you turn to the next slide, you will see routes on the bus system that have the highest intensity in terms of smart trip reloads. And if you look at the upper left quadrant, just over half of the smart trip reloads take place in the District of Columbia. About another third take place in the state of Maryland, and about 15% take place in the Commonwealth of Virginia. But as the map shows, the most affected routes are on the eastern side of the service, which is also why we have concentrated our vendor identification efforts in this region so that our customers will not be negatively impacted should the board approve this initiative. With respect to the $22 million of additional cost reduction, which is proposed in the FY17 budget, we expect the draft recommendations from consultants shortly. So over the next few weeks, staff will be reviewing those recommendations and prioritizing required activities in order to enable us to meet the budget targets in FY15. One of the questions that was raised last time on which Mr. Giancoli referred to earlier today is the impact of transit benefits to Metro's operating budget. If you recall, this slide has been shared with this board in the past, and at that time, staff estimated that the overall impact with respect to transit benefits was between $10 and $15 million. And as you can see from this chart, which compares weekly trips on the system for folks participating in transit benefits, the level of utilization falls off tremendously towards the end of the month versus at the beginning of the month, indicating when the benefits run out. Obviously, some customers will top off the benefits in order to continue to ride the system. Metro estimated then that that the lower benefits will cost, as I said, $10 to $15 million. Now, given the ridership trends and the new transportation benefit requirements in the district, we're estimating somewhere between $5 and $10 million as additional enhancement to our revenue profile for FY17. And in response to Board Member Domshio's question with respect to Metro's fiscal outlook, this chart updates a projection that was presented to this board again sometime last year. The updated expense, however, is slightly less, again, given the proposals contained in the FY17 budget. However, the outlook is fundamentally unchanged, with steadily increasing structural deficits, which are tied to with cost and revenues that we are living with today. Again, future actions and costs, revenues, and service levels will be required to address the resource gap that's highlighted here. The last question deals with a request that was made to the board last month regarding a set of locally selected capital projects. As the committee will recall, the Transit Infrastructure Investment Fund was closed in January of 2015, followed by staff engagement with the jurisdictions, as directed by this board, to identify options for funding jurisdictional capital needs. Staff provided a recommendation to the board in May of last year. However, given the focus and priorities of the FY17 capital program, additional funding may be required, or key capital projects will be deferred in order to fund any jurisdictional projects. And finally, Metro continues to dialogue with the jurisdictions about the one-year extension to the CFA. Last week, we distributed a draft language with the jurisdictions, a language that reflects the investments proposed in the FY17 capital budget. We hope the jurisdictions will provide necessary approvals later this month so that the board will be in a position to consider this next month. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll turn the mic back to you.
Okay, let's start over on this side this time. Corbett, you want to start? Any questions?
Leif.
Questions? No. Kathy? Mort?
The chart reflecting transit benefit usage. I'm not sure I understand this. And it says these are the reduction in trips paid for with smart benefits. Obviously, if you use up your smart benefit by the middle of the month, you can't pay any more trips. Does this mean that they are not riding or that they are paying in some other fashion, or do we know?
The evidence indicates that some are riding, but those are obviously paying by themselves. They're not being paid by transit benefits. Obviously, we don't have as much indication on that. What this is intended to do is simply to remind the committee that this has been discussed in the past. I don't know if you feel the answers to your question in terms of overall impact, but this has been shared in the past, and we're using the same set of information that we used at that time to estimate what the restoration impact will be in FY17.
I can report that the Department of Transportation has already put the higher benefit in place. They made it effective February. But I am hearing that some other federal agencies are pleading poverty and saying we don't have the money to do it.
That's correct.
The original executive order from President Clinton, which is still in effect, says swallow it. But it's a question of whether they will do that. I think we have to make that known to the Congress who passed this, that the administration may not be actually implementing it.
Okay, thank you. Michael.
The hour is getting late. I do have a few questions on the FY17 capital budget. You sent me a copy of it because, as chair of the Washington Suburban Sanitary Commission, so I just looked at that and it raised more questions with me. So I'll just list a couple of the entries, and either you can now or take notes and get back to the board as to what these things mean. You've got a notation down for a credit facility for $5 million.
Metro Access fleet, $12 million. The question is, does that assume that 100% of our Metro Access riders will continue to ride on the handicapped equipped vehicles, or since we're contemplating that some percentage of those could be riding on taxi like the DC service or something similar. So that my question is whether we still need $12 million for additional Metro Access fleet. You've got an item down under NEEP for $11 million. So the question is, what is that all about in light of our conversation at the last meeting? You indicated that the direction, you're skinning this down to safety and state of good repairs. But I noticed, even though it's a kind of low priority, bicycle and pedestrian facilities, which are all well and good, but I'm trying to understand how that relates to safety or state of good repair. So if you could address that as well. And finally, you have two big entries for the Southern Avenue bus garage and the Royal Street bus garage. And Andy indicated in his earlier program that these programs have been, have had a lot of delays and are just getting geared up. So my question is, are they now shovel-ready and moving forward so that we need all this money in FY17, or are we going to be spending money that's already been budgeted for FY16 in FY17 because of the delayed startups and the other construction problems that are being encountered with those two projects? If you could address that as well. I don't know if you want to do any of that now or you want to do that by
If it's okay with you, we will provide you a written response to all the questions.
That would be great. Thank you.
Yes, I appreciate this beautiful watercolor map that you have of where the high-density loading zones are. But I was wondering if there's something a little bit more feasible that I could look at to see exactly where the overlay of these areas are. It's not very clear and it's not very distinct exactly which cities and counties this is at. And for the little dots, exactly where those retail, current existing retail locations are located at, their distance to the rail lines, if they're not on the rail lines. And I know that you had mentioned seeking out other retailers. If you could plot what your potential target retailers would be also on that map, I would appreciate it as well. Thank you.
We will start out to do so.
And just so I may add, we're not limiting to just retailers, but, you know, any other you know, maybe public libraries, whatever. You know, it doesn't have to necessarily be a retailer.
Okay. Jim, you have anything? Kathy?
I just wanted to provide a little clarification on the local projects money. From my recollection of when we closed the TIF fund, the main impetus for closing the TIF fund, as I remember, it was not that we felt local projects were unimportant, but that we felt that there was money just sitting there. It wasn't in many cases being used and that was needed for other projects. And so the board agreed to close the TIF funds because they were unused money by and large. But at the same time, we got a commitment that if there was an important local project, that that could be included in regular budgeted monies. So, I mean, there's sort of an implication here that the board made a decision that local projects weren't going to be funded. That wasn't the decision we made. We closed the TIF funds for other reasons, and local projects could still be included if they were important. So I think rather than dismissing all local projects, we should look at them on a case-by-case basis. And I think that there was also a proposal out there that maybe there be a small amount of money just earmarked, a very small amount of money for, you know, local projects that the jurisdictions could determine what the priority was. Just wanted to clarify that.
Tom? Anything? Okay.
That's a good example of a successful legislation.
Well, just on that point, since this was a lively item before the PPDRE committee last year, was just, you know, it says that other jurisdictionally nominated projects are not included. Were there jurisdictionally nominated projects?
What I was referring to is the request that was made to this board, to the board last month, and simply indicating that the actions the board took last year, and to the extent that the board chooses to do this, you have to make a series of decisions, either look, which will involve either additional resources or deferral of current programs. In developing the budget, I mean, there's conversations with everyone, including the jurisdictions. Obviously, there was no specific request at that time that we could accommodate that we did not. Obviously, issues come up after or during that process, that, and I think the issue that was raised is one of those. But overall, the proposal before the board is subject to the board's decision in terms of what the final outcome will be.
So we talked about this in the context of many times the jurisdictionally nominated project might be associated with a WMATA disposition of a property. So it might be access related or other otherwise related to that. So I just want to kind of put a marker down that we haven't had any projects come for approval in the very recent past, but that's the moment at which we'd probably have those discussions with jurisdictions, and that, you know, in my committee, I'm hoping that we get a list of what's coming so that jurisdictions can be prepared and their local planning offices can be thinking about what they need in order to make sure that not only is the disposition successful, but the subsequent development at the metro station is successful, and that, you know, we include in our negotiations, both with the developer and with the local jurisdiction, any kind of access improvements we might need to really get ridership up at those stations.
Okay, thank you. Tony, anything?
One other piece of the TIF conversation, we're almost having it again, was that we wanted to ensure that the same investment criteria that we use for the rest of the capital program, we would also use for any locally proposed projects. And it's not going to open my mouth, but I want to make sure that we remember that, because I think if we don't, we lose some credibility in our capital planning process.
Okay. No? Christian? Tony? Okay. Anything else by anybody else? All right, very good. So thank you very much for your presentation. I believe that's everything that's on the Finance Committee's agenda for today. So thank you all very much. We are a bit behind, about almost 40 minutes behind. If we could all head upstairs as quickly as possible and get the meeting started, I'd appreciate that. Thank you very much.